بسم الله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Alhamdulillah, we're really honored today on campus to have Sister Hala Balani with us, who's done some tremendous work in the realm of psychology, especially for the Muslim community here and abroad. She's also been on TV in Egypt, at least, I think, other places possibly too. And I wanted to have the opportunity of her being local in Dallas, to have her come every once in a while and discuss, just have short conversations for our benefit here on campus, and also for the benefit of Muslims at large, record this and put it up on YouTube, on some things that I think are very pertinent, important to talk about, that are happening in the Muslim community and shouldn't be happening. So the first of those conversations, inshallah, is abuse in relationships in the name of Islam. So I'll give you a brief introduction, and then I'll ask Sister Hala some questions, and we'll have some conversation. At the end of it, you're free to ask questions, inshallah ta'ala. Okay? So, you know, quite a few people, you know, reach out to me after a talk, or they email me, or, you know, they'll, in a question-answer session, I'll get questions about relationships, you know, relationships of parents with children, children with parents, husband and wife. And a lot of them have to do with, is what I'm doing haram? Am I going to hellfire because of what I'm doing? And Sister Hala, she put the mic on. Yeah, so just click it on, inshallah. Am I going to hellfire because of, you know, what I'm doing? And I would say, why would you even think like this? And I get the answer that, well, my husband told me I can't go out of the house, or I can't call my friends, and if I do, I'm disobeying him. If I disobey him, I'll never make it to the to paradise, right? And parents use this kind of line against their children, you know, the guilt tripping them in the name of religion. Look at this ayah, وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا. And of course, even though it's just as painful, there are psychological abuses that are happening like this, and there are physical abuse that even happens in the name of Islam. And all of which is such a like an offense to Islam itself. So I wanted to get your insights on what you've seen, what you've observed, and how you tackle these sorts of situations.
Sure. Well, it's an honor to be with you, mashallah, today. And salam alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Salam wa barakatuh.
Definitely, this is a phenomenon that's taking place. And I see this all the time, like you said, with parents using Islam as a way of abusing their kids, as a way of threatening them. And if you see that, this is a form of fear motivation. And if you look at the psychology of instilling fear in a person, you find that the person may adhere while the person in authority is present. But when you're fear motivated, it's all about like not getting caught. And if it is, when it's instilled within you, when you have love for a person and when you have respect for a person, then you're more motivated to do things, and you do it willingly and happily, not out of just fear. So you find that, let's say we give an example of two students. One student fears the heck out of their teacher, and it's all about, I don't want to get in trouble, I don't want to be punished. And then the other student is more motivated because they love that teacher, and they feel like, wow, I want to impress them, I want to make a good impression. And you find that the level of motivation, their effort, and their work is completely different. So a lot of psychology has been done, a lot of research has been done on the fact of when it is fear motivated, your actions are fear motivated, it's not going to be as lasting, and it's going to create a negative association.
Isn't it also the case that, you know, when you are constantly using fear tactics in the name of religion, in this case, to guilt somebody into doing what you want them to do. I noticed two things. The first of them I noticed is that it can't possibly be an act of love, because your son, daughter, husband, wife, whoever, are going to be miserable throughout, because you just told them, if you don't do this, angels will curse you, or Allah will curse you. Why would you talk to a loved one like that? So it's already, like, it's a broken relationship just because this kind of language is being used. That's one. The other thing is, obviously, you know, using fear as a motivator to get somebody to do something means they didn't have anything else in their arsenal. So, just to give you an example, if a father is using fear tactics to get his son to do what he wants, then actually the father did not think the love or respect or courtesy or those things are there. So I have to use this. You're not going to listen to me because of me, so might as well use Islam to get you to listen to me.
Right.
So, which is, actually an admission of how inadequate this person is in fulfilling their role in that relationship, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. If you're relying on using this kind of like the fear tactics and not using loving compassion, because if you really want to guide your kids, if you want your wife, if you're really worried about her and her guidance and her akhirah, where a lot of people are claiming that they are, they wouldn't use that tactic because they feel like that's been proven that it's not effective. I have seen so many clients that they actually, you know, they use that fear, they control their, whether it's their wives or their kids, and what they do actually is that they drive them away from Islam. Yeah. And there are individuals that I have that they have left Islam. They go into some really terrible paths because it creates a negative association.
Because they figure all the abuse that happened to them happened because Islam was the evidence used to justify
that. Even in countries where things are being dictated in the name of Islam, people create this really negative association. Mm-hmm. And they make, you know, this rule equated to Islam, and they have a negative association towards whether it's their parents or anything that has to do with the deen.
SubhanAllah. So, you know, just on that note, I met a young woman who came up to me after a talk I did about the rights of parents. And obviously in Islam, parents' rights are a big deal. They're, mm-hmm. The ayat of Quran, the hadith are very heavy on this subject. Right. So she comes to me and she says, you know, every day I go home, and if I don't put enough salt in the food, or if the water's not cold enough for my mother, she says, la'anakillah, may Allah curse you. Like she literally has, you know, she just says it. And it really, really hurts me. Mm. So what am I supposed to do? Is me... Because you said فَلَا تَقُلْ لَهُمَا أُفٍّ, don't frown at them, don't even say uff to them.
Right.
Does, so does that work when she's saying may Allah curse you, and I, you know, because I get upset and I cry sometimes. Mm-hmm. So am I sinful for doing that? Oh. And I'm just going,
it's so sad.
Oh man, subhanAllah.
It breaks my heart. I have clients that they talk about the actual, not just verbal abuse, but the physical abuse sometimes of parents. It's so sad when people use religion as a way of trying to control them. And
so in the few minutes I have left with you, I wanted to highlight two questions.
Okay.
One of them is, what are the possible roots of this kind of attitude? Like we're, you know, especially with, you know, let's say just talk about parents towards children, even though this happens between husbands and wives also, right? But between parents and children, what would lead parents to start using this sort of tactic? That's one question. Mm-hmm. And what possible advice can we give to people that are stuck in these abusive situations?
Well, I would say that, first of all, education. If you have some knowledge on parenting, I think everyone is required to read some books, attend some lectures, have a tactic, because if a lot of times people just are ignorant, they are following whatever their parents did, and the parents did it out of force and out of beating, and so they just follow, they imitate.
Yeah.
And so I think when you have the knowledge, I mean, knowledge sets you free, right? So if you have that knowledge of psychology and know how to appeal to someone, what can, you know, how can you get your children to listen? How can you get the best out of your wife? How can you motivate anyone?
Don't you think, though, the people that are, that sort of do this kind of thing aren't interested in the learning?
They're not. They're not. That's true. That's true, yeah.
So, I mean, I figure, on the one hand, it's kind of hard to talk to people that are engaged in the crime and say, don't do the crime, because that, inshallah, it works, but it only goes so far. But, you know, one of my thoughts on the origins of this, like where it comes from, is that, for example, in the culture I come from, the Indo-Pak culture, our mothers are basically chained to the kitchen for 50 years in a row. Mm-hmm. Like their life is just serving their family, and they don't go out. They become socially isolated. As they get older and, you know, they get more and more disconnected, especially the ones that move to Western societies, at least back home, there was the neighbor's house, and you went there, and there, everybody knew everybody kind of thing. But they move to, like, England, or they move to the U.S., and they move to Australia, and there's nobody in the neighborhood, so they're by themselves all day, and then they're, like, their mind starts playing tricks on them, and our husbands aren't exactly the most, like, supportive, our fathers and our, you know, they're...
Right.
So they say all kinds of, you know, nobody likes you and this kind of stuff all to them all day, and it starts playing with their heads.
Right.
So they develop this kind of, the only, I don't have any worth, I'm worth nothing. The only time I have some worth is if I can get someone, my kids, to do what I want. And the only way I can do that is by make them feel as terrible as I possibly can.
Right.
So they'll use the most abusive language they can imagine in the expectations that if I don't do this, what other reason would they have to listen to me? Because I'm worth nothing anyway. So I have to use the nastiest language possible.
It's sad.
You know?
Yes. Yeah. And it's all the underlying cause is insecurity. You know, having insecurity, like you said, not having a sense of self-worth and not having a purpose. I really think that individuals who lack purpose in their life, they really go through the sense of depression and they do anything to cling on to people. They become very needy. So what I do with my work with women who are older and they are facing this is to try to give them a sense of purpose in their life. Like, let's say, you know, you need to find something to be passionate about. Maybe volunteer. Maybe do something khair, or maybe nourish some kind of talent that you have. Because once they have that, then they feel that their life is worth living and they don't cling on to others.
I mean, my own advice for people that are, I mean, I raised a question, but my own thoughts on this, for people that are stuck in those kinds of relationships where they're being sort of abused and being talked to in this way, is that, to me, it's a litmus test. If somebody, a loved one, has to use the religion to get you to get in line, that actually already means they are misusing, it's a litmus test for me. Mm-hmm. They're not using the ayat and the ahadith the way they should be used. That's already, you've entered the realm of abuse. Mm. Like a parent who, you know, parent and child are having an argument about which college to apply to or where to get married and all of that. And they go, فَلَا تَقُلْ لَهُمْ أَوْفِنْ وَالْوَالِدَنِي أَحْسَانَ. If they do that, you know, this is actually already an indication that there's something much deeper wrong in this relationship. Mm-hmm. And my advice to people that are stuck in that is they should not think of, yes, the ayat are real and the guidance is real, but the way it's being used is abusive. So you don't guilt yourself into thinking, oh, you know what, you're right. It's not like that. You have to fix those relationships, and sometimes kind of intervening and being honest is important. Right. You know, just to give you a scenario now, I want to get your practical advice on this. So I'm at a family where the father is just a financial wreck. Mm-hmm. I mean, the guy racks up credit card debt. He just piles it on, right? Mm-hmm. And he's got two sons, and one son doesn't do anything, and he even comes to dad, hey, dad, can you give me a new car? Can you give me a jet ski? Can you get these stupid things. They don't even live in a place where there's water, but they have a jet ski in their garage, right? So they'll do this stuff, or they'll get a car, motorcycle, or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the older son's responsible. He's, you know, taking care of things financially, things like that. And they'll just say, well, we'll just ask the older one. He'll come through. So this poor guy, every time the credit card debt racks up so much, you can't even pay the electricity bills anymore. Just call the older son, you need to write me a check. Dad, I can't right now. Oh, what kind of son are you? And then the Islamic quotations begin, right? And so the grandfather calls from Pakistan, and you know, and you need to write this check. And then he says, okay, fine. And now this guy has no savings for himself. He's got no financial situation for his own family, his own kids, nothing. Because he's constantly taking care of his father. But actually, in those kinds of cases, the question he would have is, am I doing an Islamic obligation? I'm like, well, actually, you're enabling, you know, if you want to just purely religion, leave psychology out of it, you're helping your dad accumulate more riba. Mm-hmm. Like, let's just even leave, you know, the psychology, which is abuse anyway.
Right.
But, فَأَذَنُوا بِحَرْبٍ مِّنَ اللَّهِ وَرَسُولِهِ. You know, listen up to the announcement of war from Allah and the Messenger, people who engage in riba. You're just helping your dad get more riba. You know what he's going to do with the money. He's not going to make payments towards the debt. He's just going to go get another, he's going to buy him a motorized tricycle or something this time. I don't know what he's going to get, you know?
Right.
And he'll be back doing the same thing again. So, and in those cases, you know, we have to make a distinction between the guidelines of Islam and exceptional cases of abuse where you have to actually stand up, and you don't cross a line. You don't become angry and abusive yourselves, but you have to take a stand.
You have to draw a line, at least. You have to draw a line and indicate that I will support you for the livelihood or the necessities. But when it becomes excessive like that, you're absolutely right. It is enabling the father, and he has a right for himself and his family. So there has to be a clear line.
SubhanAllah. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Inshallah.
I'm sure students have questions. If they do, I'll open that up. So there are situations where families are having some serious issues and there are no mental health professionals in the Muslim community around. So what's a right course of action? Because if you call social services, maybe they'll break up the family. So what are you supposed to do, so in case everybody can hear it?
I think definitely you need to take action, maybe get a few people within the community and to go in and talk to the brother, talk about the consequences. A case I had just this morning of the daughter being abused so much from the father that the child's protective services did get involved. They did get involved, and they had to clear it up, and it can cause a lot of problems. So what you need to do is try to intervene. Try to give that brother some support. Maybe he needs anger management. I mean, these are things that are really basic skills that we don't have sometimes as a community. Mm. And if we set up something like, let's say, if you don't have a trained professional, but maybe you could get some kind of a lecture, make sure that brother attends, and really try to intervene. Because those individuals, I mean, most of the cases that I have are individuals who have been either physically or sexually abused. And it's always been by, like, family members. And no one has done anything about it. So by you stepping up to that and trying to intervene, you could do, I mean, so much edger, and you can really protect the people involved.
Sisters and then brothers again. So on the one hand, there's so much abuse that they don't even feel a connection to their parents anymore. On the other hand, there's guilt that, you know, if I go back, they're going to do the same abuse again. Sabrina was asking about parents that had a terrible relationship with their kids, but now these kids are like in their 20s and 30s, and now they don't want to stay in touch with their parents anymore because of the kinds of mental abuse that was going on for a long time. And now they feel guilty because, you know, you can't just abandon your parents. But at the same time, they feel terrified because if they go back, the same abuse will start again. You know?
Well, this is, it's really sad and tragic when this happens, because these are the people that you are relying on, these are the people you entrusted, and it's really heartbreaking when they don't follow through and they're not really there for you. I think step number one is forgiveness. You have to be able to forgive, and maybe actually step one should be the acceptance of Qadr, understanding that certain things happen, that there is some wisdom behind it, and it's always good to ask yourself what is good about this situation. And it, you know, you may think there's nothing good about abuse, but you could learn volumes from the abuse that you have endured. Maybe you can break the cycle, you can help others who went through the abuse. Mm-hmm. So it's a matter of accepting the Qadr, being forgiving, and really trying to work through that. I would recommend, if a person has gone through this, get some counseling, you know, deal with your issues, because these emotional baggages, if you don't deal with them, you will carry them through life, and it'll affect your marriage, it'll affect your, you know, your parenting skills. So it can't, but people can work through it, inshallah. These individuals, it's sometimes as a result of wanting to become very religious and very careful and very meticulous, but they do have obsessive compulsive disorder, and they don't realize it. And so it does play a role in that. There's a lot of illnesses that are not diagnosed, unfortunately. You know, you have the bipolar, you have severe depression, where everyone just kind of accepts that, you know, auntie is just, you know, a little bit down. But it's, you know, it's clinically depressed and it's not being treated. And obsessive compulsive disorder in a religious realm has to do with, let's say, the way they do wudu. I had a client in Denmark who would take up to 30 minutes to do their wudu, and I, you know, just trying to make it perfect. And I think these individuals, they were taught by maybe a bit of a, like a staunch form of Islam, of like trying to be very meticulous, and they already had a tendency towards the obsessive compulsive nature. So perfect storm. And sometimes it's in the actual prayer. I've had clients who, they are so obsessed with their level of ihsan and their level of concentration in the prayer that they keep starting over. Like this one brother, he would repeat his prayers like 4 to 5 times. And I would, you know, tell him that this is really going to put a, you know, put a damper on you, and it's going to really drain you if you continue this. So prayer, wudu, those are the two main areas.
Thank you so much, Sister.
Inshallah, thank you so much for making the time. Inshallah, there will be some opportunity for more fruitful conversation again. I thought this was a pretty important subject because I just see too much of it. I see way too much of it to at least get some word out about it. And at least, I don't know about your situations, and don't come and say, I got to talk to you. Don't do that. I'll talk to her, inshallah. Barakallahu li wa lakum. I did, didn't I? Barakallahu li wa lakum. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.